Yeah, if you stop for a moment and think about what law enforcement will look like in the future, what's the first thing that comes into your mind? Maybe it's a scene from one of those futuristic movie classics like Blade Runner, Minority Report, or even RoboCop.
We need a 24-hour-a-day police officer. A cop who doesn't need to eat or sleep. A cop with superior firepower. It is my great pleasure to present to you RoboCop. What are your prime directives?
Serve the public trust, protect the innocent, uphold the law.
To serve the public trust, to protect the innocent, to uphold the law. Sure, it sounds great, but we're getting to a point where technology can make just about anything possible, and that certainly raises some big and challenging questions about the future of law enforcement. Is any sort of surveillance acceptable? Do we want drones and robots used in police work? Wearable devices like Google Glass can track and record every move we make, and should the police be able to access that information readily? And how about DNA testing? 1986 was the first time DNA profiling was used in a criminal investigation. What's the future for that technology and how much more sophistication is there? All fascinating questions. I haven't even asked who'll be liable for accidents when we're using self-driving cars. Will we need new road rules? Joining me to talk about the future of law enforcement, Morris Maslowski, who's a business futurist. Morris, great to see you tonight. And also, Brian Found is joining us tonight, Chief Forensic Scientist at Victorian Police Forensic Services Centre. Brian, good evening.
Yes, good evening.
Morris, I'll start with you. I mean, is the future already here as far as the technology and the policing are concerned, or is it just the tip of the iceberg?
The future's always here. Mm. The problem is there's a bit more future tomorrow for us to find again.
Yeah.
But there's certainly lots and lots that we really haven't come to terms with yet that it is on the horizon, that's absolutely imminent and will change the way that we think about policing, about the laws, about culture and society. Issues that we've never had to grapple with before, and all of them brought to us through some kind of technology beginning. Mm.
Yeah. Well, what stage are we at with the development of things like drones and robots? I think most of us by the 21st century thought that we'd have Rosie the robot, serving us morning tea. That hasn't quite happened, but we've got little things that run across the floor and hoover our homes if we want them to.
We do, and I've been waiting for the Jetsons to come true as well. All these years since the 60s. And
exactly.
That dream still... Where is she? It's a really good question. The reality is that we are on the cusp of having robots in our world real time. We've spent the last 60 or 70 years dreaming about them. In books, they go back about 100 years or so. But technology, cost, availability, all those things are starting to come together. And we're starting to see robots do all kinds of things. We need to be careful, though, because a robot, for me, is a machine that does one or two things. Mm. It's not that R2-D2 that many of us think. It's not the thing that's going to take over the planet. It's a machine that does a little bit more than they used to do before. We're starting to see some really interesting machines, robots. There's one called Baxter, which comes out of the States. Baxter is a machine that learns to do a particular task and does it repetitively. So you can teach it to pack a box, for instance, and it will pick something up and put it in the box, pick it up and put it in the box. It'll do it 24/7. You do it, you can train it to do it within 90 seconds simply by picking up its arm and showing it what to do. And the robot costs $26,000 to buy. When you start to see that kind of technology becoming mainstream, it becomes an interesting question. What else can we do with it?
Well, you've got to imagine that robots are very handy when it comes to, you know, devices that turn up in the street and we don't know exactly what's in the box. And we have the little robot goes up and gives it a shake or puts a bullet in it and it either explodes or it doesn't and probably saves a life.
And that's a much better use for a robot. So we're starting to see it come into law enforcement. We're starting to see it come into emergency services, drones and robots. A robot, of course, is a machine that walks around or does something. A drone technically flies in space. That's the two differences. We are starting to see them. They're crawling into all kinds of spaces that we weren't able to get into before, where there's a disaster and the entire buildings collapse, for instance. Human being couldn't and shouldn't get in there. We can send a robot or a drone into those kinds of spaces. They're starting to make great purpose. The cost of them is fairly low as well, which is why they're becoming more and more a part of everyday armory. And also the tricks, the things that we can get them to do, are just growing and growing.
Yeah. If you would like to text message at any stage tonight, you can. 0467 922 702. 0467 922 702. Brian, what are the biggest developments in the world of forensics at the moment? In terms of the new technology, I think just about all of us have seen at least one or two of the forensic shows on TV where they can wrap up a case in 45 minutes. I take it that's not quite happening yet.
Well, that's partly the reason I refuse to watch any of those programs.
Good career move, I think.
I think it would be. We sort of estimate that you would lose your job in forensic science approximately six times per episode if you carried on the way that they did. But a lot of the techniques that they show are real techniques. They may, of course, be much slower in real life, but the basis of it is there. Possibly what is misleading to people is the notion that forensic science personnel are those people that not only do the science but do the investigation, that do the interviews, and that simply is not the case.
Yeah. I can also say, Brian, there was a little science spot that we did last night with Tim Thwaites, and he was talking about the possibility of a little bit of DNA being able to basically pull together a facial identikit picture in 3D. And I mean, this is just the beginnings. This is the very early stages of it. But that sort of thing is extraordinary to me.
Oh, absolutely. The potential for DNA to offer far more information than just great discrimination between individuals is really here already. Molecular photo fitting, the discussion around that has been very fertile. But there's also lots of sorts of phenotypic information that we may be able to extract, subject to the appropriate legislation, of course.
Mm, you know, sure.
The hair colour, the eye colour, the skin colour, the facial features, the height of a person, and even what their ancestral background is. All of these things are already here to a certain extent.
They tell me that with DNA these days, with even the technology we have, we can probably pick the eyes and the eye colour and potentially pick the, you know, what colour the hair is and that sort of thing. That apparently is within our grasp already.
Oh, yes. In the research space, this is published already. I think what policing organisations tend to wait for is a validated commercial kit, which enables us to then apply it directly onto evidential samples. But again, that's highly dependent on what the legislation is in a particular jurisdiction as to whether you're prohibited from doing those sorts of tests.
Morris just mentioned the robots. Can you use it in forensics, particularly, I guess, if it's in accessible areas that that you're dealing with?
Well, we already use robots in DNA profiling, as it happens, and as Morris suggested, these robots do a limited number of tasks, but they do it repeatedly very well, and they do it very, very efficiently. In terms of the wider policing organisation, I'm not really an expert around that, but certainly the robots you see responsible for disposing of bombs or potential incendiary devices and drones, they are commonly in use, not just in law enforcement, but certainly in the military.
Yeah. Well, Morris, I think drones are already being used by Amazon to deliver parcels, so that just sort of gives an indication of where the technology is heading in certain areas.
Amazon's not really delivering them yet. That it was a bit of a PR stunt. So they're talking about doing it. The problem is that they won't be allowed to in the airspace. But what will happen is in Dubai next year is that the government said that they're going to start delivering government parcels using drones because they have passed it to happen. So again, technology can make it happen. We have the drones. We have the capability. We've got the GPS. What we need, which is part of our discussion this evening, is the laws around it. We need to decide as a society whether it's something we want.
This is a part of the problem. I mean, Brian, I should direct this question to you, I think. Has the legislation kept up with the technological change?
Well, it has to a certain extent. We are using these sort of techniques that require legislation on a daily basis here in Victoria and across the Australian and New Zealand communities, and we do that in a very standardised way in most cases. We have good legislation out there for constructing appropriate DNA databases, for example, constructing appropriate fingerprint databases, where not only can we search for a question sample, which is found at a crime scene, but we can also link different crimes together, even though we may not have a suspect. But the legislation is constantly being reviewed, and at the moment there is a review around 464 legislation to do with DNA, as one of the examples happening in Melbourne at the moment.
Yeah, interesting. And what about big data? How is forensic science keeping up with the volume of information on digital devices, mobile phones, home computers, that sort of stuff?
The digital environment itself, the digital landscape, is something that is very, very difficult to predict where it is going to go over the next 10 to 20 years. If we think of where we were 10 years ago in terms of social media and the like, there is a significant change in the landscape to where we are today. Of course, as the production of documentary-type evidence has reduced and more of these transactions and more of the interactions between people take place online, so there is an increase in the need for expertise within police departments to investigate leads in that environment. We are keeping up, but I think that what is certain is that unless we have a very good strategic plan around digital evidence moving forward, that it's going to be a significant challenge to keep on top of. And I think, you know, the great example of that is CCTV. This is something in the UK where there was an exponential increase in these systems. And to a certain extent, we're seeing a huge increase in the number of cases involving CCTV evidence here in Victoria.
There are a lot more CCTV cameras. I guess say the quality of a lot of the footage still seems a little substandard. Is that a problem for investigators?
It certainly is. There are no standards as such across the CCTV space at the moment, so lots of different companies will produce their own versions of, you know, a private CCTV camera for your garage, or governments might buy one for a space, a public space, but there are not a lot of standards between them. So some of the evidential product that we get is so poor it cannot really be used for anything other than intelligence gathering. In some cases, it doesn't offer much information at all.
An interesting SMS from a listener says, with DNA, can or will they take blood samples of babies when they're born at some later date, and making a crime solution a little bit easier still?
Well, that's a very hot point. They already do take a sample when children are born here in Australia. It has been argued in the past that, well, we could do a DNA profile on each of those samples and all people born in this country would be on a database. But then it comes down to really who should be considering such things in terms of its impact on the community, in terms of civil liberties. And possibly the last person that should be entering that debate is somebody like me.
Morris, it seems also to be getting to the point where there's really nothing much about us being online that is private anymore. How much of our lives can police track already if they know what they're looking for?
Well, anyone can track a whole lot of our life. The reality is we've spent the last 30 years putting our lives online, the last 10 or 15. Most people are discoverable. Different people will have different levels of information they put up about themselves, but in the right or the wrong hands, whichever way you look at it, a lot of the information we put there is accessible and usable for all kinds of purposes. So the question is, what do we do with it? Who has access to it? And we talked about big data before. And big data is the push that's on at the moment to try and make sense out of all that material that's up there.
This is part of the thing, and I think Brian just made the point as well. You know, you're getting such a volume of data, you know, who's going to look at it?
No. Well, the answer is it's synthetic thinking. The computer's going to look at it. Okay. So what we're coming up with now are all kinds of applications, all kinds of devices that will actually do some of the lower order thinking for us. It goes out and it tries to mine information that's out there. It uses what's called semantic information, semantic search, which is the ability to read between the lines, which is what you and I do as human beings really well, but computers can't. So we're starting to push down that road already. But we get into a question now of who has the ability, who has the right to be able to mine that for the purposes of law. In business, it's being done all the time. Many of the large retailers are doing this around their own databases. Many large corporations are doing it around their employees and the people that they're engaging with. But on a broader societal basis, who has the right to do that and for what purpose?
I think the most interesting case of recent years was the case of former Justice Marcus Einfeld, who in his case, you know, there was some doubt as to exactly where he was at any one point in time. And during evidence that was given in his court case, they were able to track electronically his trip from the northern beaches of Sydney to his home in the east. And, you know, there were about 7 or 8 kick points on the journey. He was using a mobile phone. He was also passing various tolls and things like that. So little things that we don't expect to be giving information are giving information all by themselves.
Well, they're leaving digital breadcrumbs along the path. But we're going to push even further than that. We're moving into a phase of wearable computers, and we start to see those already. They're devices that we choose to wear on ourselves. So in the fitness and health area, for the last year or two, there's been a whole lot of devices that we can buy that monitor our health, our well-being, how many steps we've taken, where we've run, where we've cycled. We're also moving into a phase where some people, increasingly more, are willing to life log, which means they're willing to have an application on their mobile phone that monitors where they are every minute of every day. I actually use one of those programs, and it knows exactly where I've been ever since I've started using it, how many steps I've taken, what trains, what buses, where I've been, all kinds of bits and pieces. So my question was, who has the right to access that? Am I able to use it then to be able to prove or disprove where I am and where I've been?
Yeah.
Is it permissible in the court of law?
Brian, what about the civil liberties angle? I mean, do police ever worry about it, that it's becoming too intrusive?
Certainly there is concern, particularly, and this concern may not have great basis, but particularly with reference to providing, for example, elimination DNA samples, which would then appear on a database such that if a policeman, you know, accidentally touched an object at a scene, we brought up a profile, we could eliminate that profile to sort of cleanse the evidence that we have. But there are a lot of concerns, and I can see why. People are concerned that somehow this the way that we store the code will provide information regarding their health, or may someday be used to predict disorders, genetic disorders and the like, for their children. People are concerned about information of this type, and I think it's beholden on all people involved to be perfectly honest about what this, how this data is actually stored, what it actually means, and what you can and cannot do with the data. And that's all about good legislation.
Brian, what about internet providers and telecommunications companies? Are they easy to deal with as far as the police are concerned? Will they give you information if you request?
My understanding is some do. My understanding is also that some just refused to do so. So, again, many of these providers are in overseas jurisdictions where we may have no rights to really request anything from them. So it's a lot of goodwill, I think, occurs at the moment. But that question is one that needs to be tackled on an international level. Crime is international now, and the laws of one jurisdiction as it stands may not be applicable in another jurisdiction. It's a big, big challenge.
Yes. Morris, police can obviously look at the information from the internet providers about what we're doing, but do they need some kind of search warrant or approval from courts to, for example, look at individual computers or, you know, track us really closely?
We'd need to check with the police, but I'm absolutely sure that they would require some kind of court permission to be able to look at my records or your records. So absolutely. And again, that's something that we need to consider into the future. When we talk about that, what about when we get to the day of Internet of Things where all of my information is available online? Will they be able to get court permission to not physically come into my premises but to digitally enter it, to be able to look at my equipment or my activities or anything that I carry on me that, again, has a digital emission to it? So the question becomes bigger than one of physical premises. It also includes the digital premises that we have.
Also, Morris, it's interesting, this argument's been happening in the ACT recently. They have set up a situation where it's not so much a speed camera, but they have a point and an end point. And if you've travelled at faster than the speed, they can actually pick up the fact that, you know, between point and point, you've broken the law at some point.
Absolutely.
So it's not a physical, you know, at that point you were travelling too quickly, but over that distance you were travelling too quickly.
So let's take it one step further. You talked before about self-driving cars, and we're going to see them in our marketplace within the next 10 years.
So if they crash, do you sue Toyota?
Yeah. That's a great question. But going back a couple of steps to answer the other one, the question is that do we actually need an external device that says how fast we're going if the car is autonomous, if the car is emitting information all the time and it's being able to be accessed? Should our police force have access to that car and know immediately if we're travelling too fast? Or should the car just be told to stop after 100 kilometres or 110 kilometres? So the questions actually get deeper with this new technology because we can reach into the car itself.
Pete just sent an SMS saying trucks are tracked by cameras through New South Wales and South Australia right now. Brian, what are the latest developments in the area of biometrics? And biometrics, for those not familiar, it's like scanning of your iris, your eye, facial recognition programs and the like. Are they becoming ever more sophisticated?
Oh, absolutely. There's a huge amount of investments in biometrics internationally. The major application is, of course, not in so much in law enforcement, but again, in the military. These biometrics are either based on physiological factors or characteristics associated with people's behaviour. So fingerprints we've already spoken about, DNA is a biometrics, facial recognition or the molecular photo fitting that we spoke of.
Yep.
But there are other ones. There's hand geometry, there's iris recognition, which is the front of your eye there.
What's that?
Well, there's a lot of interperson variation around your different anatomical features.
So in other words, if I pick up a cup differently than you do.
No, well, just the shape of my hand, the relative sizes of the fingers and the like will give us information that can discriminate between one person and the next. The irises are very interesting because they have a lot of individualising features associated with them. The retinal scans, which is actually looking at the configuration of blood vessels in the rear of the eye. And then the interesting movement type biometrics. There's the handwriting identification, the thought that people may be able to be identified from the way that they walk, or gait analysis, voice analysis, which has been around for a long time, and even to the point of odour, discriminating people by the way that they smell.
Wow.
So biometrics are very big.
Brian, a lot of people are asking already, fingerprints used to be, a sure sign that Joe Briggs was at the scene. DNA, does that prove to be a better, probably a better excuse, definitely at the scene?
Well, you know, the thing is what DNA does typically, particularly with DNA which you can't see, like it's not a blood drop or it's not semen, it really doesn't mean a person was definitely at the scene. The DNA may have been transferred there by other means. It might have been on somebody's bag that then put their bag onto a desk which happened to be at the crime scene. So there's more to the crime side, the investigation side, than just detecting the DNA. And that's really about saying, well, I can provide a great deal of information about who that DNA might belong to, but yes, it doesn't necessarily tell you about whether they're involved in the crime, the activity of it. Now, the great thing about fingerprints, it's a different sort of science altogether. It's not a molecular science, but rather it's a pattern evidence science. It is still used all over the world. It's enormously robust and a very reliable technique, but really different ways of coming to the problem. In some cases, somebody will wear gloves at a scene. There won't be fingerprints, but they still may leave DNA.
Yeah. Morris, what are the concerns for the public from civil liberties point of view? We've just heard from Brian that there are many, many ways now that you can be tracked at a scene and associated with a crime, and they seem to be escalating dramatically.
Well, they are. As a society, though, we need to decide what we do and don't want. these technologies are going to throw up all kinds of new challenges. They're going to give access to information that people have never had access to. There is, of course, always a sinister purpose for it, but technology itself is benign. It's only in the hands of people it becomes either an evil or a good object. And what we need to understand as a society, as a culture, is what we want to use these things for. Mm. Biometrics, of course, have a great purpose in policing. They also have a great purpose in security. Many of our mobile devices, for instance, are going to push towards using biometrics of some kind to be able to lock them down so that only the person who owns it and has the information inside of it will have access to it. So there's good and there's bad, but we need to decide again what it is we want to do with this information and with what we'll have access to down the track.
Brian, we've got 3D printing, obviously, these days, and that certainly throws up things like trademark issues and copyright issues and, I guess also the possibility of printing a gun.
Yes, and in fact, that's exactly what we did last year when there was the internet story that emerged regarding the American fellow that claimed that he produced a 3D printed firearm and videoed himself allegedly firing it. We got together with the software that was made available over the internet to all people and printed said gun. It did explode. It did fire the projectile, not very accurately, but it would have been, I think, more dangerous for the puller of the trigger than it would have been for the person standing in front of him. The Australian Federal Police have done further research around this, I believe, and yeah, there are concerns that you could print a working firearm to a certain extent, maybe a dangerous one for the shooter, but some sort of a firearm. But I guess more of a concern might be around other sharp implements that may be printed that couldn't be detected by, for example, airport scanners, such as knives and the like.
Yeah. Mm. Morris, that throws up all sorts of issues. You know, obviously with the thought of MH370 very much in our minds, you know, security on planes is obviously going to be a big issue. And if you can print yourself a gun or some explosive device, it could be quite difficult to detect.
It absolutely will. And again, it's a matter of being vigilant around it. But when you look at 3D printing, it also has benign and purposeful uses for it. We've seen some wonderful work around the medical field. Children that were born without a trachea or a faulty trachea have had them reprinted at the age of 6 weeks and put back into their body and then grown to maturity. We've seen wonderful things around faces where in the last couple of weeks, a gentleman who had his face eroded by cancers was able to have his face reprinted and put back on. We will see hearts and kidneys grown by 3D printers as well. So I don't walk away from the negative side of it at all. Mm. And there will be issues with it. And absolutely one of them will be around the notion of should we print a 3D gun, which got a lot of popular press. There will be issues about new materials being used. So there will be materials that at this stage can't be detected that can be printed. So we'll need to find how we can monitor those before they get onto planes or other situations. Yeah. But again, the technology itself offers opportunity just as it offers issues of concern.
Brian, is there much cooperation between forensic services around the world? I mean, are you in regular touch with people?
It is enormous. We have a National Institute of Forensic Science, and we've had that institute since really the late 1980s, and they've been quite key in developing collaborations, not just overseas, but between police and government forensic institutions all around Australia and New Zealand. From Victoria Police's own perspective, my group, which is in charge of research, development, innovation and scientific health across this large laboratory, we have 45 national and international collaborations as of now. As part of that, last year we had 29 graduate students, honours, masters, PhD students, all working on forensically relevant topics. And some of these topics are about new capability, for example, extracting ancestry information. Other topics are really about studying the psychology of how forensic experts make decisions and maybe even how the decisions might be erroneous. So the international forensic science community is very interconnected. Yeah. We have regular international symposiums. We have one coming up in Australia a little bit later this year. These are hugely well attended.
Brian, are you even a little bit surprised as somebody in the industry at how things are going so quickly?
I'm a little bit shocked. I think I might need to retire soon.
Me too.
Yeah, it's you know, oftentimes in industry, I think that one thing will happen and will sort of swamp all other sorts of developments for a period of time. I think science and technology is just so unpredictable, and certainly applications, applied science and applications of technology around the policing forensic space has changed so much that it's almost impossible for me to imagine 5 years from now where we're going to be.
Well, as a futurist, I guess you're not surprised.
No, I mean, what we grew up in, and I'm a cusp of a baby boomer, I grew up in was a very linear world. There was one innovation or invention, and we had time to swallow that, and we had time to bed it down before we moved on. Nowadays, we see parallel. There are so many things. There are wearable computers, there's 3D printing, Internet of Things, big data.
Well, I mean, the Internet's been there 25 years. What a change in the world that has been.
It's phenomenal, and we take for granted how much our world has changed since we put a device in our pocket called a mobile phone, and that was only 8 years ago. We have changed the world for better or for worse, but we have changed the world irrevocably because of it.
When I was a junior G-Man reporter, we had one of the first mobile phones. It was the size of a house brick. Mm. It was really good. Maurice Maslowski is with us tonight, a business futurist, and also Brian Found is with us tonight. The chief forensic scientist at the Victorian Police Forensic Services Centre. Wondering whether you'd like to talk about some of the issues we've raised tonight. What are your thoughts about some of the technology? Are you happy to see policing and criminology stepping up like this? Robots, drones, do you have privacy concerns about police being able to see all sorts of information about you online? We'd love to hear your stories as well. If you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you.
Nightlife, all across Australia. Nightlife.
Brian Found with us tonight, Chief Forensic Scientist, Victoria Police, and Maurice Maslowski, a business futurist. We're talking about the future of law enforcement in all its glory. Sam, you want a word? You want to talk about this point-to-point technology, and you say it has a lot more applications than just catching speeding drivers.
I thought an interesting example of this was a couple of years ago, introduced between Arimba in New South Wales and Wurunga at the end of, between both ends of the F3 or now the M1, there was ETAG readers installed on all of the time to destination signs. And, you know, it got me, you know, thinking about, you know, so they're reading ETAGs without, you know, making them beep as they normally would when you go through an ETAG reader. And looking into it a bit more on the RTA website, you know, that they say that they do you know, they do collect and track individual cars to calculate, for the purpose of calculating the time to destination, that they don't, you know, that they don't specifically calculate the speed, although it says on there that, you know, that they can calculate the time it takes to get from one location to another, so that they can track your average speed.
I think they're speculating at the moment that this may be the new way of charging for the development of roads, by tracking how far you travel in a day and charging you X number of cents a kilometre.
Mm. Well, yeah, that definitely there's a use there, but it'd be interesting, you know, at the RTA, if there's an internal, top speed of getting from one end of the F3 to another, a leaderboard, so to say.
Yeah,
and it's also interesting, not just from that viewpoint, but I think we're moving into an age where we're going to have UBI, which is usage-based insurance. With the cars that we currently have, and with the cars we're going to see on the road in the next few years, what we're going to see is a position where insurance companies will actually charge us in arrears for the travel we've done. It'll monitor our car, know our speed, how far we've gone, how much we use it, and send us a bill on a monthly basis for what that insurance should have been. So that's one of the worlds that we're definitely headed into, which means we could dovetail quite nicely or badly, whichever way you want to look at it, also with our driving habits and our driving conditions, whether we're good or bad drivers, whether we've broken the speed, whether we've driven properly or erroneously on the road. So these things are definitely out there and on the horizon.
And Sam, it will be interesting to see when we get these auto-drive cars. I mean, if the car is actually speeding, is it our fault or is it the manufacturer's fault?
That will definitely be interesting. But you know, a question would be for the officer there if you were trying to locate a car that used a tag that was being picked up in these systems, could that be used to help track down you know someone who's stolen a car?
Brian?
Well, not being a police officer, I don't think I can answer that, but certainly the tagging information and cameras on these roads are used in criminal investigations. But just touching on a point that Morris brought up, I think it's interesting, and it's really the difference between focusing policing efforts after somebody has committed an offence or focusing your technology in order to minimise the chance that they will actually commit the offence. And the car example is a very good one. The computer on board should allow or override a person who is speeding, which obviously presents a challenge because we have reduced revenue. But really, it's about disrupting that sort of behaviour rather than letting people continually do it and then chasing them.
And that's a perfect role for technology to have, because technology really is no more than a tool. It should be used for these lower order activities so that we can put police people back to do the higher order things that is best done by people to people.
Yeah, that makes sense. Tim, you had a question about DNA fingerprinting.
Oh, hi there, Tony. Yeah, how does it work?
Well, Brian, I think you probably know.
I think I've got some idea, although I'm not a molecular biologist, I should point that out, but I'll give it a crack.
Excellent.
Essentially, the DNA defines who you are. You get half of your DNA from your mother, half from your father. 99.9% or more of your DNA you'll share in common with all other humans on the planet. But what they've found through research, through genetic research, is there are small areas on chromosomes where there are highly variable regions. In our current system in Victoria, we look at 21 of those sites on the DNA. And these each one of these 21 are independent of each other. And there's a lot of variation between unrelated people in the population. So if you can figure out the frequency of the variation within each of the sites, you can multiply that frequency together and you get some notion of a random match probability. And that is how many other people on the planet would you expect to see sharing the same DNA profile?
So you get it down to 99.9 or...?
Well, we don't do it like that. Essentially, we give an odds, you know, 1 in 1 million, 1 in 1 billion, and with the current 21 loci, you can get up to 1 in septillions, which is, I'm reliably told, around 17 times the population of the Earth. So huge discriminating power behind these DNA techniques.
Yeah, that's fascinating. But what are the... these variant positions on the chromosome, do you know?
These are actually the ones that they use in law enforcement. Don't actually code for anything, they don't think. So they're not there to produce proteins. They're just highly variable regions. Some used to call them junk-type DNA, so they're not actually coding for anything.
Just plain as the nose on your face, Tim. That's the way it works. Todd, you're wondering, how are we going to ensure legislation keeps pace with technology?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I work in government at the moment, and I see how long it takes for acts to get changed through Parliament. They take years. How are we going to be able to react to allow or deny these opportunities or threats?
Yeah.
Todd, I mean, that's the $60 million question. That's exactly tonight's topic. How do we, in fact, make sure ahead of it that we will have legislation, that we will have policing in place and laws in place? The reality is that we are moving so fast that by the time we've recognised it, it's often too late to legislate. It really is legislating in arrears. So what we need to do as a society is we need to figure out what it is that might happen. We need to keep looking over the horizon. Too often we're thinking about what we did yesterday, what we knew yesterday to be. So the discussion about these new technologies, for one that's coming up now is this Google Glass it's about to hit, which is a wearable set of non-prescription glasses that we'll be able to buy that will have inside of them a heads-up display. And in that heads-up display, we will see things that we might normally see inside of our mobile phone. when we look into the world, we might be able to do things like facial recognition. We might be able to take pictures and photos of people that might not otherwise want their pictures taken. There are all sorts of issues around it. Already overseas, some European countries have banned that. Casinos have banned it. But in Australia, there's very little conversation at this moment about what we're going to do around these, but yet this type of equipment is going to hit within the next 12 to 18 months, if not sooner.
And I suppose, you know, technically, I mean, if the police were wearing these glasses, they could, you know, see your record, you know, driving infractions, all that sort of thing by just looking at you.
And I would love them to have that. But again, we need to have the legislation. We need to have the purpose for them to have that. And we need to say that it's okay in the court of law for them to have used that as part of a process, I would assume. So we will have great purpose for this. Medical is another one where doctors will be able to wear this and see a patient and be able to call up her or his entire records into their screen and be able to see the x-rays and everything else that's been done. So there's great purpose for it, but again, with great purpose also comes great issue. We need to figure this out.
Absolutely. I'm terribly sorry for the callers. We're going to leave high and dry tonight because there's a lot of people wanting to ask questions and make statements, but can I thank my two guests, Maurice Maslowski, thanks for being there tonight.
A business pleasure, as always.
Futurist extraordinaire, and Brian, thanks for coming in tonight. Brian Found, Chief Forensic Scientist, and I'm sorry for indicating earlier that you were a policeman.
No, there is no shame in that.
Thanks very much. Brian Frown, their Victorian Police Forensic Services Centre.